Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
This is a fraud on the American public.
The election is finally over, except according to President Trump.
Frankly, we did win this election.
What does his refusal to concede mean for Wisconsin and the Twin Ports, along with hotly contested local races? We'll speak with an expert. Then... his specialty is the bass, but he's hardly limited to one type of music or even one profession. We'll visit with Vince Osborne. All that in regional news and review after this. If there's a force behind that big band music, it's the Air Force. And the arrangement is by a local musician who's head of the musician's local. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We'll visit with classical and jazz bassist Vince Osborne in a bit. But first, there's that matter of the presidential race. The election may be over, or may not be, from one candidate's point of view. Whichever you prefer, the result probably left you with little faith in the polls. Here's a new one where respondents would have less incentive to lie. A Reuters Ipsos poll this week says nearly 80% of Americans recognize Joe Biden as the winner in the presidential race, and that includes 6 in 10 of Republicans. Will that resolve anything? Probably not. Our guest to discuss the race and local races, and even hyper-local races, is Elisa Von Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thank you so much for having me.
So going right to the big one, Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Vos, arguably the state's most powerful Republican, is calling for an investigation of Wisconsin's election results, showing again Joe Biden a winner by more than 20,000 votes. Might that be a sign of something to come when it comes to selecting the electors?
I think, first of all, the question of whether or not a recount is going to be requested is on the first order of business with respect to concerns regarding the ballots in the state of Wisconsin in general. Mm-hmm. And so whether or not the Trump administration will pursue a recount is, you know, is kind of like the first question to resolve once there are official results in that have been officiated by the Election Commission in Wisconsin. And the one thing that in this particular election, the costs will be required to be paid by Trump's campaign, and they need to be paid prior to the start of the recount. So that's sort of the first decision. With respect to the electors, so the state legislature and the governor send their own list of electors that are to go to the state capitol and then will be certified by Congress in order for this process to be initiated. And there actually have been instances in the past, I think actually maybe just one, where the list from the governor and the list from the state legislature were two separate lists.
Here in Wisconsin or elsewhere?
It's elsewhere, I believe. Okay. And so, but there's federally, nationwide, there is a law that if Congress will certify the electors that are provided by the governor of the state. And so, you know, perhaps Voss could play with the electors or do something of the sort. But in terms of having any real impact, I mean, there's really doesn't seem to be any actual legal recourse or effect that that may have, except, again, if they go through a recount and there's just some wildly outrageous shift in, you know, the votes
right.
that we...
Well, the recount is a totally different thing, right, than selecting electors. And regardless which way the results, it could happen. So that's one thing. But choosing electors, whichever way the recount went, yes, as you said, has to be certified by Congress. Certified by Congress, does that mean the House of Representatives and the Senate or one or the other?
The House of Representatives.
Oh, okay. Well, then that probably... would stymie any totally partisan effort on the part of Republican legislators.
It's, well, Perhaps.
It's well, not maybe. Nothing is guaranteed in this entire political sphere that we're in.
Absolutely. So, yes, don't put any money on that, but that's supposedly how it's supposed to happen.
Right. We are speaking with Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. We're talking about the election results, the ongoing election counts or recounts or investigations or whatever you want to call them, with or without evidence, and what they mean, and particularly what they mean in the local races. Before we get to really, really local, I'm wondering what your thoughts are, and you could have a macro and a micro, if you like, on this, on the congressional districts in our area. We have both the Wisconsin 7th and the Minnesota 8th, and not long ago, they were two of the most reliably blue districts in the country. Representative Jim Oberstar in Minnesota forever, and his counterpart, Representative David Obie. What happened?
I think it's...
You could write a book on that, I know.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, actually, there might
I'm sure there's at least one, yes. Yeah.
But I think that, I mean, it also mirrors what's occurring in the Minnesota's 8th congressional district as well, in terms of having a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat in that position for decades upon decades. And it has been, also this election cycle, been... retained by a Republican. And I think that what you see in this general area of northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota is a general aging of the population. So younger people are, in general, are tending to move, you know, out of this area. It's more rural area, of course. And so they're generally tending to move towards urban centers. And that has an effect on, you know, on vote counts. And it has an effect on the diversity of the area. And so I think a lot of that, those are, you know, key demographic players or identities that shape election outcomes. And so I think a lot of the sort of general shift has much to do with demographics and the changing demographics of the area.
Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why they are more rural areas is, in fact, both districts were redrawn, depending on your political persuasion, gerrymandered, yeah, to favor, let's put it more mildly, Republican areas. So the 8th district in Minnesota, you know, long Duluth, the Iron Range, now goes way out west to a very Republican area. And pretty far south, people don't realize it actually includes the exurbs of the Twin Cities, which, again, are highly Republican. Likewise, the 7th District of Wisconsin is also enlarged to more Republican areas. For people who are more familiar with names rather than district numbers, I should point out, the 8th District Congressman is Republican Representative Pete Stauber, who will be entering his second term, which is highly unusual. It hasn't happened in decades that a Republican was reelected in that district, as we're discussing. Mm-hmm. And Tom Tiffany, who was elected in a special election earlier this year, will be entering his, well, I don't know if you call it second term and a half or something. again, a Republican. And he succeeded a seat vacated by Sean Duffy, again, a Republican who took over from the aforementioned Dave Obie. Going to more local races, we think we noticed a pattern right after the election in our discussion last week of some of our assembly seats and others where the Republicans, again, did very well. And I wanted to say it was coattails from President Trump, even if he didn't have the coat that had the coattails.
I think it's still a little early to say for sure. I think that the the question of the issue of gerrymandering, as you raised, is key to understanding some of that. I mean, we know overall that the vote count, at least in 2016 in Wisconsin, was 56% Democrat, but they got 43% or thereabouts of the seats, and thus, you know, so that's going to have an impact, of course. And whether or not they were successfully riding the coattails of the president, I think is unclear. I think in this area, Trump is retained, you know, popularity, especially in those rural areas. But we're still waiting for the final votes to be in. So I think it's, you know, we're still, the in terms of assessing the, you know, the impact or the role of the president is just speculation at this point.
It could have been the race in general, too, right? Because we had, you know, as well publicized, Joe Biden got the highest number of votes for any presidential candidate ever, but President Trump got the second highest. And so, you know, that meant that somebody came out to vote, and with a high participation, as you point out, in an area that whether from gerrymandering or just creative district drawing, or however you want to put it, or not, tends to favor Republican elected officials.
Absolutely. I think the, as you mentioned there, the, you know, the early access to the ballot, given the pandemic and everything that was happening, really, I think, allowed the numbers of those who were eligible to vote to just skyrocket like we haven't seen before. You know, whether or not it's the coattails of the president themselves, it may just be party alignment that is driving many of these voters.
Right. And the high turnout in general.
Yes, yes.
Right. One thing I know could be misleading is looking at the map. And of course, if you look at an entire map of the United States, it's mostly red because geographically, Democrats tend to be in urban areas, as you pointed out, in cities and things like that. I just have to make this observation. Last week, we had a segment on the wolves of Isle Royale, and I noticed that Isle Royale was showing up as this red spot, and it belongs to Keweenaw County. I still maintain it should belong to Minnesota, by the way, but,
okay.
But it's Keweenaw County, Michigan, which indeed did go red. There are no people, no voters, I don't believe, on Isle Royale.
Well, that's a darn good job of turning out somebody. To
well, maybe the wolves, you know. I mean,
maybe.
We're speaking with Elisa von Hagel. She is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. We're talking about the election results or pending results or however you want to interpret it and what they mean. So having gone national, local, and hyperlocal, what races stand out to you?
There's lots of local races that are interesting. I think two things that stand out to my mind is the 73rd Assembly District for Wisconsin with the incumbent Nick Melroy was being challenged by Kern.
Keith Kern.
And
this is in the city of Superior, but also parts of Washburn and Burnett County.
Yes. And so Nick Melroy has held this seat for quite a while and has been really successful at creating different alliances with different organizations and, you know, especially with Lake Superior. You know, he has been a competent and successful assembly person for this district, and he hadn't really faced many strong challengers in years past. And what this election, we saw that Milroy had a strong challenger, Kern, and Kern lost by just 139 votes. I think what's interesting in and of itself, regardless, I guess, of the, you know, eventual outcome, is that, you know, if Milroy remains in office, the fact that he had a challenger that came so close after being in office for so long is really quite interesting. And I believe it, as you mentioned earlier, part of this high volume turnout, probably strong party unity that people maintain as they cast their votes. And so certainly one would assume that not necessarily the president coattails, but at least Republican, you know, unity or Democratic unity on each, you know, voter allowed for Kern to get really close to taking that position.
And how do you see going forward any chance that the legislative maps will be redrawn in a more equitable way, if I can say that nonpartisanly, I guess? You know, this is, of course, a census year, and it's supposed to happen. You have the Republican legislature, pretty solid, and a Democratic governor, and I think they have to come to some agreement in some way.
Right. There's a lot of moving pieces that make up any, you know, districting process. And, you know, this notion of equitable districts is it depends per state and how they approach or understand this idea of equity. So in some locations, there is an emphasis on allowing, you know, minority districts or districts that are drawn a little funky maybe, but are packed with a certain ethnic group to allow them to have, you know, their own representation. Other states focus on having very competitive districts. And, you know, so it just depends, first of all, on the goals, on what those who are doing the redistricting have in mind. Since the Republicans, as you mentioned, control the legislature, they certainly will want to draw districts that favor Republicans. And so what the population change is in Wisconsin, I'm not sure has been yet to be seen, but certainly there will be some redistricting process, no doubt. And, yeah, how the legislature works with the governor is yet to be seen and hasn't really gone well so far.
Right, probably an understatement. Yeah. Given that, what does this all mean about the American electoral system? For years, I grew up with, and I'm sure you did too, we were told and led to believe we had the best system in the world. Not perfect, but the best in the world. And I think the rest of the world is kind of looking at us right now saying, you do what?
Certainly. I think there's many proposals. There have been changes in the past. There's been a constitutional amendment to sort of fix, quote unquote, some of the challenges or the problems that we've faced with the Electoral College.
An amendment that's pending or an amendment that...
No. Amendments have been gone through in years past.
Okay.
In years past. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, so we have amended the Constitution more than once to address, you know, certain issues with the Electoral College. And again, we still have the same sort of basic structure. It is problematic. And it's an issue, though, I think that it's people become hyper aware of it during election season or more so even just right around the actual election. And then right afterwards, it sort of drops off the map. And so there doesn't seem to be sustained support or efforts on a large scale to change the Electoral College, and it just continues on. It's also a little bit difficult to understand how it all works. And I say to my students, myself, like, the more and more I talk about it, the less I understand about it.
Well, sure. Yeah. Just like my initial question to you about what Assembly Speaker Voss is doing, right? That my question was, was he planning on making it affect the electoral selection? But mm-hmm. you say no, it's probably not likely. But then again, he may have a different interpretation. So,
right, absolutely, exactly. And so I think of it as like this tiny house that was built, and then we added on wings and a new roof, and they kept adding like another floor. And I mean, and so we've just sort of had to address all of these problems by basically just doing patchwork, you know, fixes. And overwhelmingly, we see around Election Day that people are unhappy with the Electoral College, but after the election, there isn't a sustained effort or movement to, you know, create change for the most part.
Right, right. Well, we'll take a look at it again 4 years from now and realize again the house has no windows and say, hey, wait a minute. So.
Most likely.
Right. We've been speaking with Elisa Van Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, the music of Vince Osborne after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Can you be a Renaissance man while specializing in one thing or one musical instrument? I'm going to say you can be, because that's the best way to describe Vince Osborne, who concertgoers locally would know as a longtime assistant principal bassist of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra. But he's also a retired military man, a bass player with a big-time jazz orchestra, the bass instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, and showing that he cares about more than just the bass, he's the president of the Duluth Musicians Association of the American Federation of Musicians, Local 18. Oh, and those program notes for the DSSO concerts that tell you things like what Mahler was having for breakfast or thinking about when he wrote his first symphony, Vince wrote those too. Welcome to Simply Superior, Vince Osborne.
Well, thank you, Robin.
So what was Mahler having for breakfast?
Oh, my gosh. Probably some Brötchen and some meat slices and probably a cup of coffee.
Right. Changed it up, though, between the first symphony and either the ninth or the tenth, depending on what you want to call
right.
it. So I'm introducing you here as a Renaissance man. I'm going to ask you a question that people ask me since I jump around in different media, from newspapers to TV to radio here. Which do you like best? That could be classical music, that could be jazz, that could be leading the local musicians or the administrative work, or what do you like?
Oh, that's a tough question. It kind of falls into what mood I'm in or who I'm playing music with. I love playing jazz. I love playing classical music. I love and have some of the funnest times that I have is going out to Bayfield and playing at Big Top Chautauqua. You know, I love playing rock and roll when the opportunity arises. Playing music is just really, you know, it just brings me such a joy. And, you know, when I ever thought of doing something else, it always fell down to what would it take away from playing music?
Mm-hmm. And I said you specialize in one thing, but this I don't know. Was it always the bass?
Well, I actually started life as a clarinet player when I was in fifth grade and moved on to the bass clarinet when I was in seventh grade. And this was in Waseca, Minnesota. And I learned the electric bass when I was 15 years old, and that's what I joined the Air Force on, was as an electric bass player. And then when I was stationed in New Hampshire in 1983, my commander there suggested that I should learn to play the upright bass. And then the story began. So I drove down to Boston pretty much every other week to take lessons from Jim Orleans, who was a member of the Boston Symphony at the time. He's since retired.
Mm-hmm. So I get to ask you that one. Which do you like best there, the upright or the bass guitar?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the upright. It is such an expressive instrument, and I feel like it's more a voice, you know. And I shouldn't take that away from any of the bass guitar players in the world, because there's so many great ones and there's so many that I just love listening to. But for me, once I learned where to put my fingers in the right place on the upright bass, I love the sound. I love the feeling of the instrument next to me, everything.
Mm-hmm. What about the tunes? The bass is usually, of course, the bass, right? The bottom, you know.
Yeah.
But a little bit different than when you started with the clarinet and you might play more of the melody.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing because, for the most part, most bass players, the only time they ever do solo music is when they have to play a recital for college or something like that. And so you just get used to being the foundation or the bottom part, which is great, you know, and I love that. I really do. I love just being a part of the orchestra and having my part fit in with what everything else is going on, and which is just such an awesome feeling. Playing Beethoven 9 is just I get chills every time I play it. But I love playing solo literature as well, and I studied with a soloist in Germany for a year and a half when I was stationed there, and learned a lot about solo literature and solo playing, and I strive to do it. I strive to be good at it, even though I'm not the greatest, and there's plenty out there that are so much better than I, but I love having the melody and playing it, but it is just so much more difficult.
Well, people are paying more attention to you because you're the only one doing it.
Yeah, you're right out there in the open. It's hard to get away from it. Right.
No such thing as an air bowl in a solo performance, correct?
Oh, that's right. And it's all your flaws are just, you know, hanging out there. They're just, so when I listen to recordings of me playing, you know, you just get so critical, and I just hate listening to recordings of myself.
Well, we're going to force you to do one right now, to listen to one. Piazzolla's Etude. Can you set this up for us? Tell us
who
it was and what you're playing. Yep.
It's by the tango expert Astor Piazzolla, which is the who wrote the Four Seasons piece that we just played with the symphony a few weeks ago with Aaron Aldridge.
Mm-hmm. Which was based on or making references to Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
Yeah, the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires is the full title. Anyway, the this etude, it's a set of etudes that Piazzolla wrote, and I believe they might have all been written for the flute. At least this one, number four, was written for the flute. And my friend Ed Willett, the cellist from Big Top, and I did a recital a few years ago at Peace UCC Church in Duluth. And I did this kind of a transcription of this etude and played it. It's kind of done in the tango style, but kind of meditative as well.
All right. Well, let's take a listen.
Thank you.
And that was one of Piazzolla's etudes, as performed by Vince Osborne, our guest, who is very well known locally as the assistant principal bassist of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, also a member of the Big Time Jazz Orchestra, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So we were discussing solo bass, but I want to go back to take us to jazz and to a much larger sound of a whole bunch of people. You spent many years with the U.S. Air Force Band, and you've got some selections that you arranged.
Yeah, I wrote close to about 100 arrangements during my time in the Air Force for jazz band and for a rock band and for concert band, which I love doing, and usually it was for singers, and I love to write arrangements for them because we would go out to play concerts and we had singers in the band and we needed to feature them, so this was a perfect way of doing it.
So in a perfect segue, how about listening to It Might As Well Be Spring, which it perfectly follows what the seasons, right? Or the reference
right,
to the seasons
yeah.
that we talked about, which has a vocalist. You could tell us who she is and anything else we need to know about this piece.
Sure. I wrote this arrangement when I was stationed at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. I was stationed there between 1991 and 95, and I wrote it for a concert band originally, and then rewrote it for a jazz band. The singer is Sarah Granger DeLuzio, who was in the band at that time, and she's had such a beautiful voice, and I wrote a few arrangements for her that came out on that one CD called Jazz Sketches that people can find on YouTube if they look hard enough.
All right. It Might As Well Be Spring with the U.S. Air Force Band, as arranged by Vince Osborne.
I'm as restless as a willow in a windstorm. I'm as jumpy as a puppet on a string. I'd say that I had spring fever, but I know it isn't spring. I'm starry-eyed and vaguely discontented, like a nightingale without a song to sing. Oh, why should I have spring fever when it isn't even spring? I keep wishing I were somewhere else, walking down a strange new street. Spinning daydreams, I'm as giddy as a baby on a swing. I haven't seen a crocus or a rosebud or a robin on the wing, but I feel so gay in a somewhere else. walking down a strange new street, hearing words that I have never heard from a man I've yet to meet. I'm as busy as a spider spinning daydreams. I'm as giddy as a baby on a swing. I haven't seen a crocus or a rosebud or a robin on the wing, but I feel so gay in a melancholy way that it might as well be spring. It might as well be spring.
And that was It Might As Well Be Spring, as arranged by Vince Osborne with the U.S. Air Force Band. One that sticks out to me, and I've heard you play this, Dvorak's New World Symphony has what, you know, today we call a walking bass line, right?
Right.
And I don't know what Dvorak called it. So I'm going to ask you to put your professorial hat on and tell me about that.
Right. Yeah, it's so interesting. I think the first time that I played the New World Symphony, it just kind of blew me away. You know, here's something that was written quite a bit before we got into the whole style of boogie-woogie and that bass line, the 12-bar blues bass lines from the swing era and things like that. And all he did was he just wrote an arpeggio.
The other thing about this is it's pizzicato, or plucked, as opposed to played with a bowl. Again, that sort of evokes jazz references.
It does. It does give it kind of a jazzy feel. And here it is. We have Dvorak having traveled to Iowa and then also being in New York City and teaching at what was to become Juilliard. So he's being influenced. We would like to think being influenced a little bit by some of the early jazz, you know, maybe Dixieland or music prior to Dixieland that might have been heard in some different places. Then we also have to think of Dvorak coming from Bohemia and having a folk style already to begin with. And this whole idea of arpeggiated chords and things like that is not an American invention. It's been around for quite a while.
He could have gone to a jazz club in Bohemia, right?
Oh, well, you know, even just hearing the folk music from Bohemia, you know, is definitely, one could think of being like almost like jazz in some ways, you know, improvisatory, things like that. So it's I don't think it would be far from imagining him doing that.
So COVID-19, I'm sure your members of your union have a lot of changes in their life.
Oh, it's been such a challenging time, Robin. It really has. It's, you know, all the gigs that we looked forward to in the spring and in the summer and the fall, they just, everything has dried up, and you know, we've had to find other ways to get that musical outlet. And gratefully, the DSSO has returned to the stage and performing. But boy, it's been really tough. It really has.
But on the other hand, it's also been opportunities and forcing us all to be creative and come up with new ways of doing things. So the DSSO is performing socially distanced. And
yeah, it's been very interesting when we did that first concert and we'd come in and everybody's sitting about 6 or 8 or 10 feet apart wearing masks and everything. And that was an all-string concert, that first concert we did. And we had an audience of about maybe 120 or so in the auditorium, but it was great. And the audience was so appreciative. And it was such a wonderful experience to be back on stage and playing for people.
Right. And better than cardboard cutouts, too.
Right. Absolutely.
But you had a lot more of us at home.
Yes. And we have made an agreement, we meaning the local, has an agreement with the administration of the symphony to allow for live streaming and for delayed broadcast of all these concerts during this season. I'm really happy that we're doing that, and I know that there's a lot of audience members that are happy we're doing that as well, so they can remain safe at home and enjoy the music and almost as good as being there.
So another innovation that's come up is virtual performances where you're doing a duet or a trio, or where you're one place and the other person or persons are all in different places. You've got a piece you sent us, Lierre's Cradle Song, and you're performing it with whom?
Right. So this is a recording of two people from halfway around the world together. This is my friend Junko Murakami. And when I was stationed in Japan, my last 3 years of the Air Force, I played in a community orchestra in Japan. And she was one of the violinists. And we never got to play like duets together when I was in Japan. But then this whole thing started up, this COVID and whatnot. And I just felt, you know, I've got to find some way that I can reconnect with some of my old friends. And I recorded this, my part, the bass part, to the Cradle Song. And then I sent her a link to it. And then she put the two videos together. And so it was so cool that here we are, we're playing half a world apart. And, you know, other than sending birthday greetings via emails, we have not really seen each other since 1998.
All right. Vince Osborne, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking me, Robin.
Let's take a listen. Vince Osborne with Junko Murakami playing Lierre's Cradle Song.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And also our Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So we are looking at record COVID-19 infections this week nationwide and in both Minnesota and Wisconsin. Brooks, let's start with you. What are the numbers and what are the suggestions for what to do about it on the Minnesota side?
Yeah, well, on Thursday, Minnesota hit a new statewide record with more than 7,200 new cases and 39 more deaths. And in St. Louis County, around Duluth especially, there were more than 300 cases reported, beating the last daily record, which was 190, also set this week. It's just been hit after hit in Duluth and in northern Minnesota, especially Itasca County, where Grand Rapids is, has just given up on contact tracing. Duluth schools are going back to all virtual and pausing, if not outright canceling, athletics. What to do about it? It's the same thing that they've been saying all along. Wear your mask, stay home if you feel sick, get a test if you can, and always, always keep distant from folks who are not part of your family.
Right. There is nationally, the CDC has now said that the mask wearing doesn't just protect your friends and neighbors and the rest of us, but protects you too. So that might increase some use, let's hope. Danny, how's the Wisconsin side doing?
Not much better. Top health officials in Wisconsin say the state's seven-day average of new COVID-19 cases has surpassed New York's highest seven-day average back in April. The state has been seeing more than 6,200 cases each day for the last week and has been reporting more than 7,000 cases each day in the last several days. And earlier this week, Governor Tony Evers held an address in which he issued an executive order asking people to stay home to reduce the spread of the virus. But, you know, that order lacked any real teeth, because as we've seen, Republican lawmakers in the Tavern League of Wisconsin have challenged the administration's mask mandate and capacity limits in bars and restaurants. And the cases are so high in the state right now that it actually prompted health officials to release a new dashboard showing counties that had critically high spread of COVID, which basically included almost all of Wisconsin except for several here in northern Wisconsin. And here in northwestern Wisconsin, we've seen hospitalizations grow. You know, on October 26th, it was just under 100 for the region. Now it's 2 weeks later, and that's doubled, and it's creating issues for hospitals. The virus has also created problems for ambulance services, who have had to actually send COVID patients further away for care and as far away as Rochester, Minnesota.
Well, in Rochester, I believe, or elsewhere in Minnesota, the hospital situation isn't much better, right, Brooks?
Yeah, especially on the I-35 corridor, the eastern half of the state, we're seeing almost maximum capacity as far as critical care beds. About 88% of northeastern Minnesota's critical care beds, as they call them, this is the highest level ICU, are taken. That leaves less than a dozen available as of earlier this week. And now St. Luke's Hospital actually announced this week they'll be asking folks to postpone voluntarily elective surgeries and appointments.
Mm-hmm. Danny mentioned the Tavern League in Wisconsin and restaurants and bars. On the Minnesota side, what is going on?
Yeah, Governor Tim Walz this week announced he'd be doing some quote-unquote surgical restrictions on businesses, which include paring back group sizes to just 10 people, as well as ordering bars and restaurants to close at 10 p.m. Every night, and that starts today, Friday. Whether that is going to help slow the spread of the virus remains to be seen. We're told, you know, at the same time that, you know, a lot of younger folks are the ones who are seeing and spreading the virus. But we're also asked, you know, not to specifically blame them, because we all have a role in stopping the spread of the disease.
Mm-hmm. And businesses, of course, include far more than restaurants and bars. Danny, what's it look like as we head into the holiday shopping season?
Oh, well, some small businesses are offering curbside pickup, or they're offering online orders, or trying to get the word out on Facebook this year. so that they can reach people, because they're concerned that people are going to avoid coming out and shopping in person because of the coronavirus pandemic. And, you know, there's also a lot of push that's going on right now with promotions from large retailers like Amazon and Target and Walmart, who are basically encouraging people to shop early online. You know, that's a kind of trend that we've been seeing start earlier every year, but this year it's started basically at the beginning of November. And Mary McFetridge with the Ashland Chamber of Commerce decided that when she saw that, she was going to set up a promotion or work with state officials on a Shop Wisconsin Downtown promotion so that people would come out and support small and local businesses during the holidays. So a lot of them are struggling right now to keep their doors open with the restrictions they've had to put in place, you know, social distancing and safety precautions in the stores to keep people safe, like having people wear masks. Just a lot of work going on right now to get people out to buy at brick and mortar shops, which is hard because people are afraid of going out right now with the high activity of the virus. And a Google survey says that about 75% of shoppers said they plan to shop more online this year, but also 66% plan to buy more at local small businesses. It looks like people will at least stick close to home if they are going to go out and shop in person.
Mm-hmm. I know there's an effort by small booksellers to remind the world that Amazon is not the only place to get books. It sounds like an old movie from, what, the 90s now? But they kicked this off on Amazon Prime Day. One of the local booksellers is our own Zenith Books in Duluth, which reminds you, you can order from them and pick them up curbside. Another business story, but also environmental story. Brooks, some developments on Line 3?
Yeah, on Thursday, Enbridge received some key permits from Minnesota regulators to start construction on its contentious Line 3 oil pipeline that would cross northern Minnesota, ending up at the Superior Oil Terminal. The $2.6 billion project has been tied up in court hearings and regulatory proceedings for several years now, and this gets it as close as it has ever been to actually starting construction in Minnesota. The Canadian side and the Wisconsin side of this new replacement pipeline have already been completed, and so this is just the last step to get this in place. Appeals are likely. Delays could still happen, but one union official told my colleague that they expect construction to start in a month.
Well, we've been speaking with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And we've also been joined by my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
Next week on Simply Superior... All of us are familiar with this way of removing snow, but in Montreal, they also use this device. We'll tell you about the innovative techniques that have made the Canadian city an undisputed leader in snow removal and lessons we might adapt in our area. That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Vince Osborne, Domenico Dragonetti's Waltz No. 11. Stay safe, everyone.